Well, I suppose that's a good point to put in this plug. And even though we do have the screen up there, I really encourage you guys to open your hymnals and read through the music. No, there is a benefit to having the music in front of you so that you can follow along there. Not just because there's sometimes mistakes on the screen, but we want to encourage that ability to read the music and be able to sing along with it. Now, the one key when you're singing with a hymnal is that you have to be careful not to stare down at your hymnal, because then where does your voice go? Straight down, you know? So, you know, those, we used to have choirs and things, right? And those of you who sung in a choir knew this. You hold the book kind of in front of you and you sing straight out. So, yeah, make sure you do that. But we do invite you to open your hymnals as you're singing along with those hymns. We want to be able to sing wholeheartedly. And kind of a phrase that I've heard recently is sing with a full throat. I mean, just pour that worship out to God. He deserves it. Okay, let's review our days of creation, this little poetic thing to help you remember on what days God created each thing. Day one, the lights are on. Day two, skies of blue. Day three, the seas and trees. Day four, stars galore, lights galore. Day five, the birds that fly, the fish that dive. Day six, the crowning mix, and day seven, rest in heaven. We are currently going to be studying day four of the creation narrative and looking at lights galore. Starting in verse 14 of Genesis chapter 1, God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. The first day, God created the heavens and the earth, and he spoke into existence the light that fills our world. We said that we don't know where that light was coming from. What was emitting the light, he doesn't tell us, but it was there. Now on day four, God is going to create the physical light-bearing entities. And that is the command that he gives, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens." That same command as every other day, "let there be," simply means let it become. It must become as God is willing it, and so he speaks that command. So obviously God has in mind the formulation for what he wants everything to be, and it becomes as he's thinking it and as he is intending it. You know, we have a much greater difficulty in actualizing our ideas. It's very easy to come up with an idea, isn't it? But then to make that idea reality for us requires a great deal of exertion. We have to either use our hands or other, you know, whatever part of the body you're working with to make that thing become a reality. And in fact, as we're going to see later on in the creation narrative, God gave us hands because they're representations of the fact that God himself works. He shapes things. He fashions things. He does it differently than we do. He accomplishes it by the sheer force of his will. We have to interact with the world around us through the instrument of our body, and that's about all we've got, unless you believe some of those accounts of people that can control things with their mind. But we have to use our hands. We have to use our body to interact with the world around us. But God can interact with things by the sheer force of his will, and his command is an expression of that. Let there be lights. That word focuses on the basic description of what they do. It doesn't really focus any attention on what they are. And throughout the scripture, you'll find the term star to refer to just about any source of light found up in the night sky. Whether it's a comet, or whether it's a shooting star, or whether it is a star or a planet, they're all pretty much referred to in biblical nomenclature as stars. Here, they're simply called lights because that's what they do. They shine. Now we know from our study of the universe, the moon doesn't emit its own light, right? It reflects light. Hopefully you guys all knew that, right? Maybe someone out there like, what? The moon doesn't make its own light. It reflects sunlight to us. It's extremely bright because it has such a nice bright surface and it reflects all that sunlight to us. But from our perspective, that moon sure is bright, isn't it? Depending on what phase it's in. So the moon is a light in the night sky. It doesn't matter how it's producing that light. It's light to us. And so when he says, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens, he's giving that basic description about what they do, not about how they do it. Okay. So mankind since the beginning has been able to see lights in the sky. And at different times, we've understood more about how they produce the light that they do. You know, it wasn't until Galileo invented that, well, I don't think he really invented the telescope, but he sort of turned that idea of lenses onto the night sky and started looking up at those things that are out there. And we started studying, what are these lights in the sky? How do they do that? I mean, we knew that some of those lights never seem to move in relation to each other, and some of them do. You know, the planets move very quickly across the night sky relative to some of the stars. And so we've been studying those things for the last couple of hundred years very, very intently. And so it's not until recently that we even figured out how the sun produces its energy and its light. The ancient man knew it was bright, they knew it was warm, they knew it was big, but they didn't know how it produced all those things. And some of the theories were even that it was coal. It was a chunk of coal up there in the sky and it was just burning. Well, as we thought those things through more, we said, well, a chunk of coal would burn up pretty quickly if it were just coal. And we've started looking at how it doesn't. There's no oxygen up there. Now we know that. So it can't be combustion. It's got to be something else. You guys know combustion requires a fuel and oxygen to produce heat. That's what fire is. Well, the sun is not technically fire because there's no oxygen out there. It's a nuclear reaction. It's like nuclear bombs going off all the time. And I think it was only in the last 20 or 30 years that we've kind of resolved the debate of whether it's nuclear fusion or nuclear fission. You know, is it splitting atoms or is it fusing them together? And they've done some tests detecting neutrinos, and they finally determined it has to be in the core of the sun is nuclear fusion. You're taking hydrogen atoms and smashing them together, which releases immense amount of energy, and you're creating helium atoms out of it. And sometimes that goes up the chain. You take two helium atoms and put them together, and you get whatever four is. Periodic table expert? Beryllium. All right, so you get beryllium, and you can take those together. And yet, stellar core can produce things up as high as iron in their core, and then they shoot those elements out in the solar winds. But again, that's just illustrating that it doesn't really matter in the biblical narrative how they make their light. They are light bearers. Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens. And in the expanse of the heavens harkens back to what we learned on day two when God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters and let it separate the waters from the waters. God created this great expanse, and as we looked at the biblical terminology on that, said that includes everything above the surface of the earth. It's the earth's atmosphere, it's outer space, all the way to the edges of the universe are what the Bible calls the rakia, the expanse. And so today, on day four, what he's commanding is that in that expanse, within it, God is putting light-bearing objects, and he's filling the rakia with it. They have a purpose, which he designates in the next statement, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. So three stated purposes he gives to these light-bearing objects. The first of those is to make a distinction between the day and the night. Let them separate the day from the night. Well, that's a very easy thing to observe. Right now, it is what time? It's daytime. How do you know that? You say, look outside. It's light. There's a lot of light out there. And after, at this time of year, after about, 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, you're going to go out and say, oh, wow, it is nighttime because it's dark. Now, the great thing about what God accomplishes here is that even though the nighttime is darker, it's not totally dark, is it? Because in his graciousness, God has provided that we never dwell in absolute darkness. Even in the nighttime, God has provided lights for us. Those little twinkly stars. We watched a video series here on Sunday school and culminated this morning with just this phenomenal exploration of some of the stars that are out there in space. And they are magnificent. And they're huge. From our vantage point, they look kind of small. And we sing a little song about it. You know, twinkle, twinkle, little star. And I love how he drew that out this morning. Say, these are anything but little. They're huge. They're massive. God put them in the night sky to make a distinction between day and night. The distinction is so drastic even that the daytime light shields out the nighttime light. You know, the stars are still there, right? But you go out in the middle of the daytime and look up at the sky and you cannot see them because the sun is so flooding us with light that it drowns out the nighttime sky. Unless you're looking at it during an eclipse. How many of you saw the full eclipse last year? Oh, wasn't that beautiful? And you watch the moon slide in front of the sun and see the stars begin to appear in the daytime sky. It's a little bit unnerving, really, because we are so used to this order that was started on this fourth day of creation that there's a massive distinction between daytime and nighttime. Daytime is light. Nighttime is dark. When that sun comes out and floods the daytime sky with light, it totally shrouds out the stars. But even at nighttime, God hasn't left us without some kind of light to walk by. And it varies quite a bit, depending on whether the moon is out. You know, and we have all those things like the harvest moon, where you can go out and plow your fields by the light of the full moon because it's bright out there. But God created the lights in the nighttime sky. I'm sorry, not just the nighttime sky. God created the lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth to make a distinction between day and night. And ever since day four, that distinction has ruled. It hasn't been undone. Well, he gives a second purpose for all of these lights in the expanse, and that is, let them be for signs and for seasons and days and years. Now, we have to be careful when we say there about signs. There have been some interpretations of that word to make it sound like we should be using the stars to give us signs of what God wants us to do. Or, you know, even the gospel in the stars. Anybody heard the theory of the gospel in the stars? They reinterpret the zodiac to try to be pictures. Instead of pagan pictures, they try to make them biblical pictures and say, well, the stars are actually preaching the gospel. And it's a creative theory. The trouble is the scriptures never say anything about it. And you think if God were going to put the gospel in the pictures of the stars, he would have said something about it in his word to clarify it. As far as we know, no pagan nation has ever come up with the gospel by looking at the stars. They always come up with pagan ideas, which is why when you look at your newspaper, you can find a section on astrology in your newspaper, and you can, you know, I wouldn't recommend reading it, but you know, you could read that and get some fun entertainment. But there are a great many people that think the position of the stars determine the courses of people's lives. And we're not saying the position of the sun and the moon and the stars have zero effect on this earth. As we're going to talk about later, tides and things have a very real and positive effect on this earth. But this, when it says here that the lights in the expanse are for signs, he's not talking about those kinds of signs. He explains what types of signs he means by the next statement. What kind of signs? For seasons, for days, and for years. We mark off the rhythms of life by the position of the sun and the moon and the stars in our sky. We know literally what season we're in by the position of all of those things. And I'm sure that you have studied a little bit about, you know, what makes the season a season. So here we are in winter. Why is it winter time? Because the earth's tilted away from the sun. It's actually not because we're further away from the sun. We're about 1 million miles closer to the sun now than we are in the summertime. because of the way the Earth's orbit works. But we're tilted away from the sun, so we receive much less direct light from the sun, and therefore it gets colder. Now, of course, on the southern hemisphere, they are tilted towards the sun, so they're in the summertime right now. But that tilt of the Earth and the positioning of the sun relative to the Earth, or I should say the Earth relative to the sun, is what gives us our seasons. And as we circle around the sun, those relationships change, and we go through the seasons of our year. We go from winter to spring to summer to fall and back into winter again. And every year we mark this cycle that God established right here on day four. It's day four that put the tilt on the earth. And I don't think it's that God took the earth and tilted it a little bit. Understand, there's no such thing as tilt when you have no other reference point. Right? If you're out in space, how do you know if you're upside down? You don't. There is no upside down. So God created the earth on the first day. When God, you know, day one, God created the heavens and the earth, and then he spoke light into existence. The earth was there. But there's no such thing as tilt when there's no other reference point. So when God created the sun, he put it in such a way that it looks like the earth is tilted towards it. And that's what creates our seasons. And so the lights in the sky literally have this purpose to mark off seasons and days and years. And so now we know the rotation of the earth was going on back on day one because there was already a first day and a second day. There was morning and there was evening. So the earth was rotating relative to whatever was emitting the light in those first 3 days. But now all of that light's been gathered together into the sun, which we're going to get more details on here in just a moment. But God brings all of that light together into the sun to be the source, the primary source of light onto the earth. So the earth is spinning, and now we're spinning in relation to the sun, we're orbiting the sun, and we have the establishment of days and years. When God puts the moon in place, we have the foundation of our months. And we mark off the seasons and rhythms of our lives based on the positioning of these stars and these lights in our sky. They have a profoundly huge effect upon us because of the natural rhythms and cycles that they create. Every 28 days or so, that moon circles the earth. Every 365 days or so, the earth completes its orbit around the sun. 584 million miles the earth travels every year, just making its way around the sun. You probably don't feel it right now, but you're very much a lead foot. You're traveling at 66,000 miles an hour around the sun. At the equator, the earth is rotating about 1,000 miles an hour. That's why if you travel up further north, you're moving slower. So, you know, you get a little vertigo moving southward. These were all put there to give light on the earth. They were put there to measure off these rhythms of life for us by giving us days and months and seasons and years. And they accomplished very well what God intended them to do. And then, he says, the third purpose for them is to give light on the earth. Let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And as we said, they do that very well. During the daytime, we are flooded with light from the sun. And during the night, we get this gentle blanket of light that keeps us from stumbling around in the darkness because God's given us the moon and the stars. Now, he's going to elaborate on that in just a little bit, but after he gives us this four-word phrase that speaks volumes. This is the fulfillment of the command. See, the command came in the first sentence, let there be. And then he says, and it was so. We've emphasized every day of the creation week the importance of this phrase, that what God speaks must come to pass. It is the power of God's word that he can accomplish anything he intends. That's the power, the mighty hand of God. And again, not that he has actual fingers that do the work for him. But God wills it to be, and it is. In such a profound and powerful way that God wills there to be these millions of points of light in the sky, and they become. They form themselves in obedience to his command. It was so. Now, verse 16 and following is sort of a commentary on that. If the first phrase is God speaking his intention to create something, the second phrase is God's accomplishing of that thing. God made the two great lights. And so we get a little bit of a greater detail here in what God means by let there be lights. So God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. Now, it should be obvious what he's talking about here. The greater light is the sun. It is the greatest light in our sky. It's the biggest thing that we see because it is so very close to us. There's a picture of it. Don't look at the sun directly, by the way. It'll burn your eyeballs. You have to have special filters to get pictures like this. But what a marvel. What a beautiful thing that God placed there so close to us. And I didn't know if this morning we were watching a video on Louis Giglio. And that's not indescribable. What was that one called, Daniel? How Great is Our God? Okay. Great video where he talks about the sun and the different stars that are out there, which we're going to get to. But you'll hear it said sometimes, and a lot of times this comes out of the mouths of naturalists and evolutionists, that our sun is it's an average star in an average solar system. And that was a very popular theme for quite a while, but we are learning in the last couple of decades as we peer deeper into space and more closely into space. How many of you heard of the James Webb telescope? A few of you. How many of you heard of the Hubble telescope? All right, Hubble was launched in the 90s, and it was this premier thing. It let us look deeper into space than we've ever been able to see. Well, just a few years back, they launched another one called the James Webb telescope, and it's sending us back pictures of much, much higher resolution than the Hubble ever could. And we're seeing deeper into space, we're seeing with more clarity, and what we're finding out is the sun is anything but average. It's not the largest star in the sky. But that's a good thing. As they talked about in Sunday school this morning, if our sun were one of the largest, we'd be baked. One of the great things about our sun is not the fact that it's 93 million miles from us, so that's kind of somewhat common knowledge. It's not the size of it. It's 864,000 times the diameter of the Earth. You can fit almost a million Earths inside of it. It's huge. It's 330,000 times the diameter. Did I say that already? 330,000 times the diameter. I said 864 times. Yeah, it's 864,000 miles in diameter. So how long would that take you to drive across? The sun makes up 99.86% of the mass of the solar system. You think about the size of Jupiter and Uranus and Neptune. Those planets look huge on the pictures we get from them, and yet they're just these little like granules of sand compared to the Earth, or sorry, compared to the sun. The thing is huge. And it puts out, get ready for this one, 3.846 times 10 to the 26th power watts of energy. No wonder we're trying to build all these solar arrays and capture some of that. 3.8 and then add 26 zeros onto the end of that. And that's how many watts of energy. How would you like to pay that power bill? Well, a wattage isn't per time. It's kind of, that's just what it's putting out all the time. At any given time, yeah. It's a measure of available energy, and the sun's putting out that much energy. So if we were a little bit closer to the sun, we'd be cooked. If we were a little bit farther away from the sun, we'd freeze. God has placed the Earth in just the right relationship to this star to make life possible on this planet. But one of the great things that we've been discovering recently about the sun and its uniqueness is that though it's not average size, it's actually on the smaller size of stars, its stability is unusual. Most of the other stars in the universe that we are now seeing that are the same size as the sun are in what are called, they're in double systems. There's two stars rotating each other. And can you imagine having two stars in our solar system rotating each other? Double the amount of energy hitting the Earth all the time, and what would happen? Our oceans would boil away. The gravitational effects would just make life impossible on this planet. And so while the sun is a somewhat average size, what's unique about it is that it's alone. It's a single star, and we're not finding that in too many other solar systems. Its stability of output. Many of the other stars that we see that are a similar size and composition as our sun are what are called variable stars. They're constantly pulsing. Different levels of energy all the time. And now they only vary by a few percentage points. 3-4%. But you know what 1 percentage point of increase in the sun's output would do to the Earth? It raises the average temperature on Earth by 1 degree Celsius. Do you know what happens if you raise the average temperature on the Earth by 1 degree Celsius? It gets bad. Now, that's average temperature. Now, if you're saying right now it's 36 degrees, I would love to have it be 1 degree Celsius warmer. Yep, that's not how that works. Average everything out to 1 degree warmer, and you get major, major effects on the planet of the Earth, much larger storms. You get much higher precipitation rates. Some places, then, you're going to get higher than average snowfalls. It gets really bad here on Earth if the sun just gets a 1 percentage point higher. And the stars that we're seeing that are similar in size and composition to the sun are variable by 3 or 4 or 5%. But our sun outputs its energy at such a constant rate that even with our modern instrumentation, we cannot detect a variation in it. It might be varying, but it's such a small variation that we don't see it. Why is that? Because God created the sun to give light on the earth. And if that sun were not lighting at a constant rate, life on this earth would be impossible, if not just very, very difficult. But our God established the sun for his purposes. The sun's not just another star. But he also created the lesser light to rule the day, the moon. I didn't put a picture of the moon up there, so you're going to have to look at the sun a little bit longer. Right. We've looked up in the night sky, and we marvel at this thing. The moon is a fascinating thing to look at in a telescope. Because the clarity that you can see by looking at the moon, since there's no atmosphere on it, is just breathtaking. You zoom in and look at all those little ridges and valleys on its craters and things, and you say, that thing is amazing. And there it just sits, floating about 280,000 miles away from us. But the moon has a pretty profound effect on us, aside from just the light that it gives us. It affects our tides. It stirs the oceans. You know what would happen to the oceans if the moon weren't there? They'd become stagnant. How many of you ever put up one of the, you know, temporary swimming pools in your backyard and you forget to clean it and chlorinate it and see what happens to it inside of a matter of a couple of weeks? They get ugly fast. Well, imagine the oceans doing that. But God put the moon there to give light on the earth to stir things up. And that light gives us light at nighttime, so we're not in total darkness. It's also perfectly sized and aligned to create solar eclipses. And this is also rare in the universe. When we look up at the sun, and again, don't do this, it'll hurt you. If you look up at the sun and measure the distance of it, its angular width, and you measure the moon and its angular width, you know, they're just about the same. But the moon is so much smaller than the sun, but God put it so close to the earth that its apparent size in the sky is just about the same as the sun. So when that moon slides in front of the sun, it can shield it out and give us that beautiful, beautiful experience of seeing a solar eclipse. I think it was back in the, 300s BC, one of the Greek philosophers or scientists was the first to be able to predict solar eclipses. And they were realizing, yeah, this is not a strange occurrence of the gods manipulating things. This is a regular patterned event, and we can predict it. Why is it a regular patterned event? Because of the way God set things up. That moon orbits us, circles the earth once every 28 days or so, and every once in a while, it passes between us and the sun, and it blocks out its light for about 4 or 5 minutes, and we get to see that spectacular view. God put that moon there to give light on the earth, and it does exactly that. Now you'll notice three little words at the end of verse 16. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. A lot of attention on the sun and the moon because they are by far the brightest things in the night sky or in the sky. I think by definition, if the sun's out, it's not night, right? When you measure the magnitude of the brightness of stars, the number goes down. The lower the number, the brighter the object. The sun is something around negative 26. For visibility, the dimmest thing that you can see without a telescope in the night sky is like a luminosity of 6. So you go from 6, or the things you can see, all the way up to negative 26, the brightness of the sun. But at the end of verse 16, God makes this fun statement, almost like an afterthought. Oh yeah, and the stars. He made the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And that's all the commentary we get about him in the creation account. He doesn't mention much else about him except verse 17. He set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. There's that restatement of the original purpose for which they were created. He made the stars. I think some of your translations add an also in there. Literally, it does just say, and the stars. So they're part of this creation of the lights in the night sky, but God made things like this. Everything you see as a light in the night sky, aside from the moon, would be classed as a star. So again, whether it's a comet, or whether it's a shooting star, or whether it's a planet, the scriptures kind of refer to them all under that broad terminology of a star. Now, because we have been studying things, our modern nomenclature gets a little more specific. So we know there's a difference between a star and a planet. Planet's this little chunk of rock floating through space, and it reflects a lot of light at us, but we see it in the night sky as a light. But we see the stars. And as we were saying earlier, our sun, about a million times the volume of the earth, and there are stars out there that are about 1,000 times the size of our sun. Anybody stargazers? You like to look up at the night sky? From here on out, I want you all to do it at least once. To stand outside and look up at that night sky and just say this phrase, He made the stars also. God is the one who set these things in place. And again, it comes without commentary about how He did it. What composition are they? That's part of the wonder of studying the creation, that we can point telescopes up at those things and measure them with spectrometers and say, well, that star is mostly helium or mostly hydrogen, but there's some helium and lithium and iron and some other things in there. Isn't God amazing? Look at the variety of stars. You know, they're not all yellow. In fact, most of them aren't yellow. We have this beautiful yellow dwarf star that we are so close to, and it gives us daylight. Still the best light under which to view things. And I know, that's a commentary against LED lights. I'm not a big fan, but you know, they at least light up the house. But you can't compare them to daylight. Even the ones that are labeled daylight don't quite do it, do they? Because we're trying to mimic what God did, but we can't. He put those galaxies up there. Groupings of hundreds of millions, billions of other stars. Some of them much smaller than our sun, like the white dwarfs. Some of them much, much larger, the red giants. The one they mentioned this morning in Sunday school is in the constellation of Orion. You know, if you look at Orion and you see his belt and you kind of go up, to the upper left corner of him, you'll see a reddish colored star, and that's Betelgeuse. Not the movie. Crazy as it is, most of our understanding of astronomy from the ancient world comes from some pagan sources, and so they named the stars and the constellations after their gods. Betelgeuse is a demon. Love to call it that, don't we? Interestingly, we're going to see here in a couple of moments, the Bible actually references several star formations like the Bear, Orion, and Abby's favorite, the Pleiades. References them and talks about them, but one of the ancient Eastern names for Orion was not Orion, but Nimrod, the fool. The Bible labels it as the fool. Now, why would you call Nimrod the fool? Because he's the one that instigated the rebellion at Babel. Puts a little different spin on that. I forgot the word. Astrology chart, doesn't it? He made the stars. Now, the creation account, we've been trying as we go through this to answer some questions about objections to the biblical narrative throughout our study here. And we've been able to answer, I think, a lot of questions because I want to be able to equip us all to be able to answer those questions when people raise them. Say, well, what about this discovery? What about radiometric dating? Well, actually, that doesn't work so well because radiometric dating gives dates that are all over the place. They're not very reliable. Well, what about rocks? How do we get all the rocks here? Oh, actually, large amounts of water in a short amount of time can lay down an awful lot of rock, like Noah's flood that we're going to study in some weeks to come. One of the major questions for recent creationism, as we're asserting, the Bible clearly says the earth is about 6,000 years old, give or take a few years, one way or the other. You really can't even stretch that to 10,000 years based on the biblical text. If you're going to try to stretch it to 10,000 years, number one, it doesn't solve any of the so-called scientific problems. And what it does create is still a lack of trust in what the text says. So why stretch it to 10,000 years? It doesn't solve anything for us. Based on the text alone, you come up with about 6,000 years age for the world and the universe. And as we've seen, the earth is actually older than the sun, not vice versa. Because here we are on day four of creation, we've got an earth, we've got oceans, we've got plants covering the earth and living in the oceans, and we just got the sun. Plants are older than the sun by a day. The earth is older than the sun by 3 days. And so stretching those things to 10,000 years, all that does is do a disservice to our trust in what the Bible says. It doesn't solve any of the so-called scientific problems. Well, I want to lay out for you one of the scientific problems that we do have in young earth creationism regarding the stars. And that is, how big is the universe? It's huge. Current measurements, about 13.8 billion light years across. Our galaxy itself is 100,000 light years across. Our nearest star, Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away. Meaning that if light were traveling as fast as light does, it'd take light 4.3 years to get here. But day four, God says, let them be for lights on the earth. And it was so. God speaks it into existence, and somehow the light from those stars is reaching the earth, even though they are many, 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 many miles away. This is called the distant starlight problem. And briefly stated, the problem is, if God created all of the stars and galaxies on day four, how did the light get here so fast? According to our modern measurements of light, and our current understanding of physics, it should have been 4.3 years before Adam saw the first star in the nighttime sky, other than the sun and the moon. He would have seen the sun 8.5 minutes after God created. Well, actually, Adam was created a couple days later, so Adam would have woken up in his first existence and the sun was already shining, and the moon shining at night. But the sky would have been starless for 4.3 years, and then, boop, there's one star. And then over the next couple of thousand years, boop, boop, stars begin appearing. It's a distant starlight problem. And the honest answer is we don't have a solution for this yet. There have been a couple of proposals I want to go for. Some of the solutions that we have presented to try to explain this phenomenon. But before we do that, I want to state the conclusion of it. So I'm going to give you the spoiler alert. It's good for us to explore the created world. We've been saying this since the beginning of this study. Marvelous are the works of the Lord, studied by all those who delight in them. Psalm 111. We want to study the created world. We want to build our foundation on God's word, let it inform us about what God has done, and then go out and study the created world to see what marvelous things God has done. But that doesn't mean we know everything yet. But what do we know? What's right? God's word always. And scriptures consistently give us this testimony about the Bible. Forever, O Lord, your word is settled in the heavens. So if God says he created the stars on day four, then on what day did God create the stars? On day four. Pretty simple solution, right? So just because I cannot, in my current understanding of the physical universe, in my current scientific understanding of the universe, I can't explain how that happened, does that mean it didn't happen? Because you know, there's some other things I can't explain. How can a male child be born to a woman that's a virgin? Cloning, obviously, right? Petri dishes, in vitro fertilization, you know, those all require a man. Still do. It's not scientifically explainable, it's a miracle. A man that's been dead for 3 days, coming back to life, his wounds are no longer wounds. How do you explain that? Scientifically, you don't. So there are a lot of things about the creation narrative, and we've said this from the beginning, that there is miraculous stuff going on here. There may or may not be a scientific explanation for how God did it. As we looked at the previous day of creation, when God says, "Let the earth sprout forth vegetation," we said the picture there is that these things poke themselves up out of the grounds and a rapid process of growth took place. So that in that one day of time, a little less than one day actually, plants went from little sprouts all the way up to full-grown trees, and not just full-grown, but bearing fruit. So that on day five, when God creates the birds and the fish that need to eat, they have food. They have full-grown food ready for them to consume. Any naturalistic scientific explanation for how that happens? No, there's not. But God can do that. So just because we don't have a scientific explanation for how the light could get here doesn't mean it didn't happen. And we have to remember that. So some of these explanations rely a lot more on a physical process. And there's actually one of them that just says, who knows? God must have done it. That's enough for us. And I'm not saying we shouldn't study it. I think people should study it. Say, is there a possibility that our understanding of the universe is not quite right? That's never happened before, I know. And that's something to understand too, that even our scientific perceptions of the way the universe works, they change. Sometimes it's a refining, sometimes it's a total upending of what we thought we knew. And so don't look to man's interpretation of the evidence to give you confidence. God's word is what doesn't change. So, what are some of the solutions we've thought of? Number one, the stars aren't actually all that far away. Well, sounds good. Trouble is, there's a lot of experimental, verifiable evidence that says those stars actually are that far away. The distances are not really in question. Okay? One of the ways we measure stars is by triangulation. It's called parallax. Fancy word. You got to pay a lot of money to know that word, right? But parallax means that when the Earth is on one side of the sun, we measure the angle to the star. And when the Earth is on the other side of the sun, we measure the angle to the star. Now, since we know how far it is from this side of the sun to that side of the sun, we have the bottom leg of our triangle. And how many of you loved doing trigonometry and geometry in school? And you said, oh, I loved all of those theorems that could prove all the sides of a triangle, if you know, what was it, two angles and a side. Side, angle, side, side. Oh, I forget what they were. Angle, angle, side. You had to know three pieces of information about a triangle, and then you can solve the others. So if we know the distance from this side of our orbit around the sun to that side, it's about 186 million miles, And we know the angles that we're measuring to look up at that star. Now we can measure the height of the triangle and we can get the distance to the star. That's verifiable. That's easy to do. That's not based on presuppositions about how old the Earth is. That's simply based on observational science. And that number can get us up to several hundred light years away. So, we can measure stars that are several hundred light years away. We know that's how far away they are. This universe is huge. So you say, well, maybe some of the stars aren't millions of light years away like they think they are. Well, maybe they're not, but it doesn't matter. If it's several hundred light years away, we still have a problem. Because how did Adam see the stars the day he was created? So, even if we're off by a few percentage points in our measurement of how far away the stars are, it doesn't matter. So that question doesn't really answer anything for us. The second solution is that God created the light in transit. So he creates a star 3,000 light years away, and he creates this beam of light going out to the earth. And we base that on the idea that some of the Psalms talk about God stretching out the heavens. Like, okay, we took this star and we pulled the thread out of it. Now we have this beam of light going every which direction from the star, so that God created the light already emanating from the star to every point where it was going to eventually go. The trouble is, that beam of light is telling us a story about the life of that star. Now, back in the early 1980s, we observed a supernova. There was a star there, it expanded, and it blinked out, and it's gone. That star was 100,000 light years away. So, if God created that beam of light already in transit, that means that star never actually existed. It wasn't there. God created a beam of light that's telling us a story that never happened. And the question is, does God do that kind of thing? Is he going to give us information from these stars that are coming to us that presents a false picture of what the universe is like? Like it's just some galactic mirage. And so that idea of God stretching the light or creating it in transit actually creates another problem for us theologically that we'd have to deal with. Third option for solving this light travel problem is called C decay. Sometimes you'll see it as the letters C, D, K. I'm writing that in my perspective, so it's backwards to you. But C decay, C is the mathematical symbol for the speed of light. And decay means it's slowing down. This hasn't been brought up in quite a while. It was a little more popular in the late 70s, early 80s. But the idea was that if we look at our measurements of light going all the way back to the first experiments in the 1600s, there's been a decrease in the measured speed of light. And if we extrapolate that backwards, we get to a little past 6,000 years when the speed of light would have been nearly infinite. You say, well, that's interesting. Wow, that lines up with the biblical chronology pretty well. Does that mean that the speed of light has been slowing down and only reached an equilibrium in the last 30 or 40 years? The trouble is, the speed of light, if you change it, changes everything we know about physics. Think about E equals mc squared. Energy equals mass times the square of the speed of light. Albert Einstein developed this theorem to describe what we know about the composition of matter, and if you change the speed of light, you change the composition of matter. It creates a huge problem in physics if light is slowing down. Okay. So that one's not being brought up all that much more, but also because as they looked at that curve of measured speed of light, they realized the early experiments had a very broad margin of error. And the margin of error actually comes down to the measure of light that we see, that we're measuring today. And so it's not a slowing of light, it's a refining of our measurement process. And we're actually getting the correct speed of light now. Well, another one is called the gravity well theory, and the idea there is that if the Earth is near the center of the universe, then light is actually gravitationally accelerated towards us. Interesting theory. Don't know if that's the right one or not. The last one that I know of is really, it's kind of interesting if you're into mathematics, but the idea is that there is actually no real way to measure the speed of light in one direction. So, Ed, I'm going to turn on my flashlight, and we're going to have our stopwatches, and I'm going to click mine when I turn the light on, and you click yours when you see the light, and we'll compare them, right? Okay, let's say you can do that with super refined electronics that are timed and precise. The problem is, according to theory of relativity, movement affects your experience of time. So what happens? Ed gets his measurement. He clicks his stopwatch when he sees the beam of light. Now he walks toward me to tell me what time he got. Guess what just happened? He threw off the synchronization of our clocks. Well, how'd we synchronize our clocks to begin with? Maybe he and I were standing together, and I said, all right, go. And we both start our clocks at the same time. Well, he walked that way, and according to the theory of relativity, that changed the synchronization of the clocks. They're no longer synchronized. Okay. So there's no possible way to measure the speed of light in one direction. All we can do is shine a light on something, bounce it back at us, and measure the two-way speed. And so this concept says, well, what if we just assume the speed of light is infinite in one direction? It doesn't change any of the math, any of our physics. It just changes the way we think about it. And I just throw that one out there because I like thinking about math like that. It's kind of fun. But it tells us there are theories for how to answer the problems. Which one's the right one? We don't know. But here's what we do know. God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, to give light on the earth, and it was so. There's a couple of things that the scriptures tell us about the stars. You can write these down if you want, or just reference them. Psalm 147, verses 4 to 5. He determines the number of the stars. He gives to all of them their names. Great is our Lord and abundant in power. His understanding is beyond measure. The deeper we peer into the universe, the more that beyond measure becomes. To the visible eye, there's something like 3,000 stars visible in the night sky to the naked eye. As we peer deeper into the universe, we've actually found out there are countless billions of them. And God knows the names of every one of them. Now, how beyond measure is his understanding? When we see stars interacting with each other, gravitationally pulling on each other, you see some pictures of stars that are actually, this big star is pulling the mass away from this star. You say, his understanding is beyond measure. How did he do that? How did he create that? Great is our Lord. That's our conclusion that we've got to come to. Yes, we should study the creation to see what sort of marvels God has put out there, but always with this end goal in mind to say, great is our God. His understanding's beyond measure. And it doesn't matter how far I peer into the universe, I will always be finding that he baffles me. He's beyond me. He thinks better than I do. He's smarter than I am. He's more powerful than I am. Why do I ever fear anything if this is my God? Isaiah 40, 25 to 26 takes it to that very question. To whom then will you compare me that I should be like him, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. Who brings out their host by number, calling them by name? By the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. God calls the stars by name. And he uses that to point his people to say, who is like me? And our answer's got to be, no one. There's no one like you, Lord. As we referenced for our call to worship this morning, God asked Job this question: can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? And Job has to answer, no. Now, what chains is he talking about? What's holding those things together? Why is it that Orion always looks like Orion in the night sky? It doesn't change. Abby, why do the Pleiades always look the same? And they have for thousands of years. I think it's one of the reasons God made the universe so big, is that gives it stability that we need. But what are those cords? And somehow those things are interacted with each other. Gravity is our best description of it, but they're held together. And God holds them there, and he asks Job that question. Can you bind their chains or loose them? Can you make those stars drift apart and dissipate? And Job has to say, no, that's above my pay grade. I don't understand that. Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? Can you guide the bear with its children? Who's the bear? The Big Dipper. They called the square of the Big Dipper the bear. And those three little stars that we call the handle, there's the children. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? You know, we're just trying to ply into these things. We're just trying to delve into them. We don't understand how it all works. How does the universe work when you get outside of our solar system? It's beyond us. We don't know. There might be some whole new law or principle of physics that we're not understanding that'll solve this whole starlight problem. And we just don't see it yet. But God does. Can you establish their rule on the earth? Do you know all the ways that they're affecting you? And again, Job has to say, no. And Job's response needs to be all of our response. I put my hand over my mouth. I'll refrain from speaking in your presence because I do not know enough. You are God, and I'll trust you. So as I said earlier, what I want you all to do, even tonight, you step outside. Yes, it'll be cold. It's okay. You can see the stars better when it's cold. And look up at that night sky and pick one of them and look at it and remember, God made the stars. So what are you afraid of? I'm going to have our